M. Jackson, W266, DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original reporting.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. CBS's Robert Costa reports that former President Donald Trump's legal team is expected to contest former Vice President Mike Pence's grand jury subpoena on executive privilege grounds over Trump's handling of classified documents. Costa also reports
CBS News has just learned that last month at Mar-a-Lago, former President Trump's Florida estate, his lawyers found a folder marked as classified, and they have turned that over to federal agents.
FBI agents today searched former Vice President Pence's Indiana home, leaving with one document with classified markings and six additional pages.
Success.
It was a success, said President Biden, after giving the order to have an object flying over Alaska shot down. More from CBS's Stephen Portnoy.
The White House is making a point to illustrate this object was much smaller than the Chinese balloon shot down last week.
The way it was described to me was roughly the size of a small car.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says the unmanned object was flying at about 40,000 feet from the time it was discovered last night to the time it was shot down today over the northernmost part of Alaska. Kirby says the president ordered it shot down due in part to the possible threat to civilian aircraft that fly at the same altitude. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, the White House.
Even among death and destruction from the earthquakes in Turkey and Syria on Monday, CBS's Chris Livesay reports there are miracles to be found.
Successful rescues still happen. A 10-day-old baby spent nearly four of them buried alive. His mother was also saved. And baby Aya, which means miracle in Arabic, born amidst the rubble. Thousands from around the world have offered to adopt her, but she's going to live with an uncle.
More than a dozen survivors were found in Turkey today. However, in Syria, the country's civil war has made it more difficult for international aid to arrive. The CDC says norovirus, a highly contagious stomach bug, is rapidly spreading across the country. CBS's Bradley Blackburn.
The CDC tracks data in 14 states across the country, and 225 outbreaks were recorded from August of 2022 through this past January. That's up from 172 outbreaks from the previous time period. Symptoms can include diarrhea, vomiting, nausea, and stomach pain.
3 years after Johns Hopkins University started tracking the unfolding COVID-19 pandemic, the Coronavirus Resource Center will stop collecting and reporting data on March 10th. However, Johns Hopkins University Associate Vice Provost Beth Blauer points out,
all the data that has been collected up until our cutoff point will be intact, and it will be hosted on a site here at Johns Hopkins University.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 169 points. This is CBS.
WAUK 540 AM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Governor Evers wants to increase spending for the Department of Veterans Affairs by $24 million. $9 million would go toward new programs for veterans. Almost $8 million would be used to hire new nurses or give current nurses at the state's veterans' homes raises. The governor unveils his full budget proposal next week. Former Packers star quarterback Brett Favre is suing two sports commentators and Mississippi's state auditor for defamation. The lawsuits accuse Pat McAfee, Shannon Sharp, and Shad White of lying about Favre in the media. Favre has long denied he knew he was part of a plan to divert welfare money to build new sports facilities at his alma mater. In sports, the Bucks beat the Lakers last night. Earlier yesterday, Milwaukee got former Marquette star Jay Crowder in a four-team trade. Milwaukee sent point guard George Hill to Indianapolis. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens, inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripescast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis.
every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. We talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
Governor Tony Evers, Tim Michaels said you had gone, quote, full woke. Dr. Jill Underley said that somebody who says that has no idea what we're doing in schools to make sure kids feel safe.
We want to make sure all kids feel supported. Tim Michaels, we don't teach CRT in our schools. You got to come to the present century here, Tim, and be cognizant of what actually goes in the schools. My guess is you've never been in a public school in Wisconsin.
Up North News Radio with Pat Krylo airs at its new time from 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays across Civic Media.
WAUK 540 AM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio, streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com. A progressive voice from Manitowoc to Janesville, WAUK 540 AM, always streaming at waukradio.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it's being reported out of western Pennsylvania, eastern Ohio, where this train derailed, that the Norfolk Southern Rail train had been on fire for several miles before it derailed in eastern Ohio. And a lot of questions going on about what happened here and a lot of questions about the safety of communities and all this stuff. And I've been anyway, I got a lot of questions. That's why I've asked Jared Cassidy to come talk with us. Jared is the Assistant National Legislative Director for the SMART Union, the Sheet Metal Air Rail Transport Union. smart-union.org is their website. Jared, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
You know, as I said, I got a lot of questions on this because, you know, the reports that we're seeing coming out, this is a scary thing. I mean, some dangerous chemicals, evacuating areas, not something you see every day.
No, it's not. And it's one of the realities of railroading that a lot of people take for granted. I mean, we haul a lot of dangerous materials and you know, really, we've been lucky in this country for quite some time that we haven't had more accidents like this. We've been sounding the alarm for some time, ever since the beginning of precision scheduled railroading, which we can get into in a minute. But, you know, the realities of moving freight across this nation's rail network, you know, there are risks involved and cuts to the system and cuts to manpower and cuts to all kinds of things over a handful of years here recently have exacerbated this reality, this issue. And you're seeing, unfortunately, what we've been predicting coming to life.
Do we have any idea what caused this at this moment?
So I got to be a little bit careful here because we are involved in assisting the NTSB in the accident, but I can speak to what has been made public, and I can tell you from the videos that have been released, it's obvious that there is one particular car and one particular axle that is on fire and has trouble. As a railroader in general, that's not an uncommon scenario to see, and so that we know that one car and at least one axle had gone bad for whatever reason. I cannot speak to the specifics on that, but we do know that you have one axle that is bad on one of those one of the cars in the train.
Yeah, because here's the thing, and this is what bothers me. Anytime something like this happens, they always blame it on human error. It's always the worker's fault. And I look at the fact that we've had these conversations over the last year or so about the fact that this industry has gone away from having enough labor on the trains to now, you know, I guess two-man crews eventually still wanting to go down to one-man crews. So for me, I look at this as an outsider who, you know, I know nothing about the intricacies of the industry, but the fact that they've gutted the amount of workers in this, it leaves me with an uneasy feeling. And I gotta think to my core that there's something with that.
Yeah, so let's talk about precision scheduled railroading and what it's done, and we'll call it PSR from here on out. It's easier to spit out quickly. Like I said a second ago, it's cuts to everything. Like you alluded to, they have made reductions anywhere they can make reductions. And I'm not going to tell you that this caused it, but I will tell you that PSR has caused the elimination of a multitude of carmen. The carmen craft has typically and historically been the craft that did the inspections, especially at originating departures. They are identified as the qualified mechanical inspectors within the regulations. But unfortunately, in our regulation or our regulatory system, what it says is inspections have to be done by qualified mechanical inspectors where they're present. And so these railroads, to save a dollar, they just eliminated the carmen craft. And because they've done that, they're shifting the burden of the inspections from the carmen onto the conductor. But the problem is that the conductor, one, is not educated or trained to the level that the carmen is. Number two, we're not provided the tools to do the inspections that the carmen do. For example, the flange on the rail wheel, the little piece that sticks out that keeps it from going over the rail, it has a thickness. And the carmen possess a tool to measure the thickness to make sure it's in compliance. Conductors don't have that tool. And this is just an example, but we don't even have that tool. So we cannot perform the level of quality inspections that carmen can. But because the railroads just simply eliminated them, now that burden has shifted to us. You know, and we're doing inspections that we're not taught to do, we're not qualified to do. And the inspection quality as a whole and the industry as a whole has just deteriorated. And you're starting to see that. Another piece here too with precision scheduled railroading is everything is so rushed. Everything is being expedited so quickly that the time that people used to be able to have to make their inspections on cars, for example, the carmen historically had roughly about 3 to 4 minutes to inspect one particular car. There's 120 points that they try to touch and hit to make sure everything is good. Now they're pushing them down to about 90 seconds, 60 seconds a car is all they're allowing folks to actually look at the cars to make sure they're expected to you know, expedite the speed in which the train gets out. You know, it's safety be damned. Let's get the freight over the road. That's the new approach. I'm not saying it caused it in this accident, but by God, I am telling you it is a problem in this country, and I would not be surprised to find out that it's the smoking gun here, too.
So let me stop here, because look, you know, I've driven a truck for years. We do a pre-trip inspection on you know, when we at the beginning of the day, at the end of the day, and a lot of times in the middle of a trip, and I just to pre-trip a truck, just the 18 wheels, I give myself anywhere between 18 and 20 minutes. You're telling me that these giant cars that are, I don't know, are usually the size of two tractor trailers that you can put on top of them, you have to go through a 120 point check in 3 minutes per car. And each of those, and these trains are what? I think the last time we talked, you said some of them are upwards of 5 miles long. I'm not sure how you do that as the guy who's driving the train. I don't know you got enough time to walk that 10 miles around the train to check every car.
Well, I mean, you don't. You have to some degree, but, you know, it's not just 3 minutes per car. That was the old time. We're down to 90 seconds per car now, and it's not a responsible way to perform safety inspections for the equipment. The rule should be that you take as long as you need to take to make sure the equipment is safe, not just for the crews, but for the public to prevent exactly what it is that we're seeing in Ohio. And I feel terrible for the residents of East Palestine, but let's be honest, we got extremely lucky that this didn't happen in downtown Chicago or downtown Cincinnati or downtown Pittsburgh. We got extremely lucky. Had that happened in that situation, it's untellable just how bad things really could have gotten because of the density of the population. And that's our greatest fear as operating crews or as any railroad worker for that matter. You know the territory you traverse and the potential that we have for disaster, and it's always in the back of your mind. And you know, and I feel bad for the people of East Palestine, but in a way, we kind of got lucky that it wasn't more in an urban area.
No, you're absolutely right. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Jared Cassidy. Jared's the Assistant National Legislative Director for the SMART Union, the Sheet Metal Air Rail Transport Union. SMART-Union.org is their website if you want to take a look at the work that they do. And I want to come back to this precision scheduled railroading, as you say, PSR, and basically what it's done to an industry that was a solidly, you know, upper middle class kind of job, family sustaining industry that people made careers out of. As I'm being told, and I go into the railroads, rail yards quite often, They're having a hell of a time trying to find people to come work for these railroads because of how bad things are. Is that what you're experiencing?
Absolutely. I don't know why anyone would want to work for the railroad the way they treat their people right now. I mean, you know, on one hand, you've got railroads that are actively announcing that they're trying to eliminate the conductor from the cab of the locomotive to take it down to a one-person crew. But then they act surprised that they can't get people interested in becoming a conductor when they're actively telling people they're trying to get rid of that job altogether. So your future doesn't look too good. But this is a huge conversation, Rick. So if you look at precision scheduled railroading, right now we're so short on people that they're offering these enormous hiring bonuses, but people don't want to come there. And so they're hemorrhaging employees right now. Our mid-career, late-career people that are quitting the industry, giving up railroad retirement, giving up all the benefits, is at a level that we've never seen before. And so the talent, the education, the knowledge that is walking out the door is leaving. And now we have this huge vacuum of talent and all this other stuff that we should have in there. And you've got these new people coming in. And precision scheduled railroading, everything's got to be done faster. We had training programs that were up to 6 months. For example, Norfolk Southern went from 18 weeks to 6 weeks. They cut their training program to 6 weeks, and they're throwing these people out there that aren't educated. They don't know what they're doing. They're lost. So the system slows. You've got that issue going on. You get to the inspection piece. You've got guys that have been led through training in such a way that they've cut every corner. They don't really know what they're doing. And it's all of these little things that are just compounding and piling up, and it's taking a toll. And then you go out there and you work in the field, and the officers of the railroad, and I am not lying here, will literally hide in the weeds with binoculars and watch you to catch you doing anything wrong or to make sure you're working at the speed they want you to work with. There is no additional training or education in the industry. What they do is they just fire you. It's our way or no way, and that's how it runs. I mean, if you look at the equipment or the cars they drive around, the managers, the windows are so dark you can't even tell if someone's sitting in there, because they don't want you to know if you're in there. They want to watch you. If you're out there doing your normal functions, they will literally fly drones over your head with the sole intention of operational testing you to catch you doing something wrong. They don't care if you're doing something right. They don't come out and say, hey, good job. You did a very good job today. When you see their face, it's because it's about time to get fired. And then you compile that with the fact that we don't have sick leave. We work 24/7, 365 days a year. And you've got drivers for Walmart and trucks now that are making more money, at least advertise more money. I mean, you can't hire people in that scenario.
Yeah. And there's part of me that goes, that's part of the plan, to get to having nobody on the train and running these things with computers. Last line of questioning I want to get to, because the other thing that came up is the fact that we haven't made massive investments in the rails, that we're really operating on old technology. We have no idea of what you know, the final result of the investigation is going to be here. But I got to imagine, you know, our rails are old. I got to imagine, the fact that we haven't upgraded in decades has to play something into this, no?
I would think so, yeah. So the brake system we're using is the Westinghouse system. You as a truck driver know the Westinghouse has been around for a minute. And, you know, it was some of the original air brake systems that we had back in the late 1800s. There was an overhaul of the brake system in the mid-1900s. But you're talking about very, very old fundamental equipment when it comes to the actual cars of the railroad system. The locomotives have advanced quite a fair bit, really, but the cars themselves have not seen any real changes. I mean, maybe some minor stuff in the valves or gaskets or things of that nature, but principally speaking, you're talking about very old, or at least equipment that was designed half a century or more ago, and it certainly is an issue. Yes.
Yeah, last question. Are your members okay? Did they come out of this okay? Are the folks who were on the train okay in this?
Yeah, the members thankfully were okay. They acted very fast here. This is another reason, thank God, we did have a second person in the cab of that locomotive. They were able to, one, identify that a derailment had happened quite quickly, two, recognize that it was hazardous materials, and three, they were able to tie handbrakes on the train to secure it or prevent it from rolling incidentally, and then also put the locomotives away to give themselves separation between the actual incident and where they were. But they handled it very well, did everything they should have, and very proud of them. But all in all, they are good. They did go to the hospital, but from my understanding, they're doing pretty good now.
Good. Well, I wish them the best, and you know, the people of that area, I wish them all the best. And look, I hope we learn something from this so that it doesn't happen again. Jared, I appreciate the time, though. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jared Cassidy, the Assistant National Legislative Director there at the SMART Union, the Sheet Metal Air, Rail, and Transport Union. Check out their website, smart-union.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. We'll take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible two-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to therickssmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at therickssmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Can I go back to this and look at the reality of it? This industry. Like a lot of industries, it's like, hey, how can we get the cheapest labor possible? How can we get the most exploitable labor? How can we lower our labor costs the most? And, you know, yesterday I got an email from somebody who, you know, basically asked the question, you know, you're such a big union supporter. You're such a big union guy. You know, what do labor unions do? Saying, look, you know, the exact question, what do labor unions protect that labor laws don't already protect? And this is one of those interesting things that people think, well, I don't need that stinking union. The laws are in place. You know, those unions fought for workplace safety laws. Those unions fought for minimum wage laws. Those unions fought for, you know, for maximum hour laws. We've got it already. And the frame, you know, there was something we needed 100 years ago, you know, when children were in the mines and we were literally losing 100,000 people a month to workplace deaths. But through, you know, OSHA, through, you know, the Department of Labor, and through, you know, child labor laws and, you know, maximum hour laws and minimum wage, through all of these things, we made things better. So this idea, we don't need it anymore. We've already got it all. And, you know, to those people who go, well, you know, what do unions do that aren't already there? Empower. Because here's the thing. All the laws in the world can be on your side. If there's no one there to enforce them, if there's no one there to point out that someone's breaking the law, what good is it? If in your workplace you're so afraid of the boss that you're not going to say that he's stealing from you out of fear that he's going to fire you, because we live in an at-will employment country unless you have a collective bargaining agreement, people are afraid. And I'll give a perfect example. My daughter came to me not too long ago with a friend who was saying, look, you know, they make me work through my lunch. They take the lunch out of my paycheck, but they make me work through that lunch. Are they allowed to do that? And the answer is no. The answer is flat out, absolutely, positively, under no circumstances can they do that. No. The law is on your side. go to the wage and hour division at the state. Oh, I can't do that. I'll get fired. So what do unions do that labor law doesn't? Make sure you don't get fired for standing up for your rights. And I know, I'll go get a lawyer. Good luck on that. You're going to dig deep into your pocket. And this is what employers know. These lawyers, they don't work for free. You know, $300 an hour to win you a half an hour of lunch money? Really? You going to spend that? This is where unions, again, I could go on all day on why unions are important and why having a voice on the job is important and why we collective bargaining agreements are important. But you want to know what they do when the laws are even on your side? They give you access to them. That's not hard to figure out. I say it all the time. You know, when I'm driving the truck, I don't take an unsafe truck on the road. Brakes are out of adjustment. Hoses are leaking. Lights are out. Anything. Doesn't matter. Fix it. Not moving it. And yet I know people who don't have that sense of empowerment. Bosses, take it or go home. Those are your choices. So that's what a union does. Any other questions, feel free to reach out, rick@thericksmithshow.com. That's where you can get a hold of me, and I will answer all emails. I got an interesting email from someone in the Netherlands, though. Someone who listens to our podcast, and thank you for tuning into the podcast, who basically ran through, asked why I use the term working class so much. And I said, look, you know, because I want us to understand that the working people of this country have a common identity, a common identity, common goals, that we're all in something. The idea of solidarity, of we all understand what it's like to go to work and punch the clock and the abuses that can come. And this person, you know, went through and said, look, you know, when I backpacked across the U.S. 50 years ago and told them where I'm from, you get X amount of, you know, vacation days and X amount of sick days. They couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe that you what? You get all that vacation? You get paid time off? You know, this person worked in a restaurant. And back then, even, it was customary to work, you know, half an hour after the restaurant closes for free. And the workers, even today, don't see anything wrong with that. Just how it is. Whereas this person's going, no, you get paid for the work that you do, the time that you, that's how it is. And it's amazing to me that, you know, when you look outside the U.S., workers' mindsets and their views are very, very different. Yeah, they're loyal to the company. They want their companies to succeed. They want them to do well. Again, as I say, every company I've ever worked for, I want them to do wildly well and make as much as they can off of my labor. So that when contract negotiation time comes around, we can grab some more of that. They get better. They get better returns. Their lives get better, but so does mine. So do the workers. So do the people who actually go out and create the wealth, who make the wealth. And these are the conversations that we don't have enough of in this country, because we're divided by all the other nonsense, by all the, you know, the you name the outrage. And then we don't get outraged by the stuff that, you know, matters. This is amazing to me. The fact that people will get ripped off, they will get robbed from, and well, just take it. But boy, you know, you talk about taxes. Oh, fuming, flaming at the mouth. Quite remarkable. But I look at this railroad industry. What has happened over the 50 years that, you know, from when I remember, people who've spent their lives there, and the stories that they tell of it getting progressively worse because we've consolidated them down and consolidated them down. There isn't any competition. It's not like these conductors can just go to a different railroad. This is the problem with monopolization. Well, I think back in the 80s, there were, 40 different railroads? Now we're down to, I guess, 6. And I love my conservative friends who tell me how much they love competition, they love the free market, and they love all this stuff, when we don't really have that. You want to talk about what's causing our inflation? You want to talk about what's causing our supply chain issues? It has a lot to do with the fact that we've allowed them to monopolize, which is why we need a Federal Trade Commission to start breaking some of this stuff up, starting with the railroads. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. Let's take a quick break. Right back after.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk from Butler to Windlake. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. CBS's Robert Costa reports that former President Trump's legal team is expected to contest former Vice President Pence's grand jury subpoena on executive privilege grounds over Trump's handling of classified documents. Today, the FBI searched Pence's Indiana home.
FBI officials conducted an exhaustive five-hour search, leaving with one document with classified markings and six additional pages. Pence and his family were traveling in California. His team fully cooperated with the search.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby confirms that President Biden ordered an object flying above Alaska to be shot down.
We do expect to be able to recover the debris since it fell not only within our territorial space, but what we believe is frozen water.
An earthquake ravaged Hatay, Turkey. Rescues are ongoing, but are becoming fewer, and millions have been left homeless. CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM, Wisconsin's home for rational talk radio.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Van Nair. Here's what you need to know. No charges will be filed against a former Wisconsin Democratic leader who was involved in a fatal car crash in Ashland County. 27-year-old Alyssa Ortman of Pennsylvania and her 5-year-old daughter were killed in the crash involving former Senate Minority Leader Janet Bewley on July 22nd. Bewley pulled out of a beach entrance and into the path of Ortman's vehicle. After that collision, Ortman's car spun across the road where it was struck by another vehicle. Wisconsin State Patrol records show Ortman was driving 100 miles an hour at the time. Your chance to get free COVID-19 test kits is ending soon. With the federal government ending the national public health emergency this spring, vaccines and at-home test kits will come with a price tag. Moderna and Pfizer both plan to increase the cost of their vaccines 3 to 5 times what the government was paying. As of right now, you can still get free at-home COVID tests from COVID.gov. I'm Jane Matt-Nair. This is Civic Media News.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram.
Monday mornings at 8 on the Shaw and on the Civic Media app.
Monday morning at 8, don't miss Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring legendary Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Football, life, and fun.
Earl, you've been driving a Yugo. They just gave you a brand new Ferrari with turbo boost. So enjoy it, brother.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Monday morning at 8 on the Shaw. 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
It makes me smile and you have a piano, but if you can play the Peanuts theme song.
Oh, oh my gosh.
You know he can.
Yes.
On the Devil's Radio.
Yes. Yeah. I love it.
Listen to Max Inc. Radio Saturday night, 6 p.m. to midnight on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Veterans, whatever you're going through, don't wait. Reach out. Find resources at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach. Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like the FBI has, found some new classified documents. There seem to be everywhere. More at Mike Pence's house. Again, there's part of me that goes, the plot here is to make it okay for Trump to have them. There's part of me that goes, because it just now seems to be all over the place. I wonder if they wallpaper their basement with it. Just crazy. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, well, you know, more classified documents. I wonder if Bob's got any. That's why I've asked my good friend Bob Ney to come talk with us, former Ohio congressman, political analyst on the road as we speak. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick.
So have you been going through your stuff? I know you said you had some boxes and stuff. You got any old classified documents laying around?
I just was actually talking to my brother-in-law. He asked me that very question about 15 minutes ago. I said, maybe. But let me throw this out here. Think about this for a second. Let's say that I have a meeting with somebody in an embassy, and it's classified, and I leave, and I don't have documents, but I make notes. And I put those notes in my files, and those files are eventually taken to my house when you leave Congress. What about that?
No, it's another good question.
I mean, I haven't heard this asked anywhere. Should that be? Because this happens all the time. You know, they don't tell you, you can't reveal, but they don't tell you to not make notes.
Well, the other question that I have is,
put it in your file, is that count too?
Yeah, but the other question I have is, you know, don't they retroactively, you know, classify stuff that when you got it, it may not have been classified, but they went back and classified it later? Because I remember a lot of that coming up during the Hillary years.
Well, that's true. I mean, or some of it was classified, some redacted, and then later they change, you know, some of the material that was not redacted into classified because of the context. I mean, there's all kinds of things like that that could happen. I mean, it's amazing this stuff just still turning up places.
No, it's incredible to me that we're this inept. I mean, evidently, it's all over the place now.
Well, that's what I said. All these QAnon conspiracy people that give the government such clever, you know, such clever attitude. You know, the government is so swift and can do this to you and that to you. Just look at this. I mean, this is kind of an example where the government doesn't have its act together.
No, this is where, you know, I've got a lot of 9/11 conspiracy nuts, and I can't believe I'm going to say this out loud because the emails will come. But, you know, again, you know, look how inept they are in dealing with certain things. There's no way they could have put together that kind of sophisticated attack on our own, on ourselves, and someone not have left a note, a memo, told a girlfriend. I don't know. It doesn't seem possible to me.
Right. And then through our history, we have so many examples of human error through administration after administration. Where, you know, something was supposed to be taken care of and it wasn't, and human error on, you know, classification of documents and computers and secrets. I mean, just it happens so much.
Yeah.
And so, but this one is what's really bizarre, I guess, is that the system really doesn't track all of this stuff. Or somebody would have known what was in Pence's house or Biden's or Trump's, or Obama's, who knows if they find one there, or Bush, you know? You would think that when it comes to the classified, because the classified documents, they don't just say, here's a pile of classified documents. They all have a you know, series of security things attached to them, whether it's numbers or digital or microchips or whatever, it's attached to them. And so you would think that, you know, the records section would know that.
So isn't this a moment where Congress should, figure this out? Say, you know, maybe need a classified records act to ensure that, if they're classified, I mean, if they are top secret, if it isn't this important to keep this stuff close to the vest, don't you think you should, devise something to make sure you're tracking it right?
Well, Congress loves to investigate everything under the sun. And this is one thing, you know, they really don't need to investigate as much as they need to say the system doesn't work, foolproof, for classified documents. Let's see how we fix it. You know, they don't need a 9-month investigation. And politically, as you and I have talked, I mean, politically, this is now criminally, politically, it's all a wash. It's all it's all been thrown into a bag, shaken, and everybody's coming out looking alike.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, if I remember right, Ruben Gallego, the representative from Arizona, was asked about if he had any of these classified documents, and he said, no, I'm a millennial. I do everything digitally, nothing on paper, in his view. Is digitizing classified documents the way forward? I got to tell you, as an old guy, anything online seems to me to be a bad idea, but I'm curious, any thoughts?
If it's online, it's going to be found.
Yeah, it's going to be hacked.
Yeah, it's going to be hacked. Now, another interesting point was raised about Congressman Santos potentially coming into briefings, you know, because of his constant lies. I thought that was interesting. They raised it. By the way, just so listeners know, when you get elected, you sign an oath that you will not reveal classified information under penalty. Some members do not sign that oath, by the way.
Right.
They don't feel that they should. And in the past, a member would walk into a briefing and then, you know, somebody would eventually come up to me and say, you know, what's he doing here? You need to tell the sergeant of arms. And then the sergeant of arms would ask the person to leave. You know, that's how it operates. But that's members don't have a background check. That's, you sign that, and boom, there's your authorization.
Wow, that's you brought up Santos, and Santos got himself in a little more, and even deeper lies, because evidently he claimed that Kyrsten Sinema consoled him during the State of the Union, and Sinema's office is saying no, that didn't happen.
Right, and then I saw the Romney tape of him talking to him, and then I was saying today in my news notes that you can do a lot of things. You know, I got in trouble. Other people have gotten in trouble. You can do a lot of things. People have not paid taxes, on and on and on. But, you know, when you do anything involving an animal or a puppy in particular, you're done.
You're done.
This is America. You are done. He bought puppies. The check bounced. Then he sold the puppies at a charitable event. What do you want to bet, Rick? They're going to find out something about the sale of those puppies.
Oh, there's no question. But, you know, it used to be, you know, dead hooker, live boy. That was the end of you. Now it's puppies.
Right. Now it's puppies. Yep. Animals in America. Absolutely. Especially puppies.
Wow.
He's done. That was it.
That's the final straw. All that other stuff. Oh, yeah. The slew puppies. Of everything else.
Well, you know what they say in D.C.? If you want a friend, get a dog. He sold his dogs. He's done.
So you're predicting he's out the door now. That's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. It's a matter of time for him. And the point Romney made was really, really appropriate, because he sat where he knew members, you know, he would try to get somebody to shake his hand just to try to say he's connected, or he's, you know, the president shook his hand or whatever. And so, you know, it wasn't illegal what he did, obviously, but it was, you know, bad taste and protocol. So, you know, Romney called him out for that.
So did the president shake his hand?
No.
Oh, good.
And no one did. I'm sure that the president was told, whatever you do when you go down there, you know, don't
if anything, slap him.
Don't look at him. And, of course, what was interesting was Romney, when he was going through Statuary Hall after this all happened with Romney and Santos, and they asked him, this is after the State of the Union, the press said, what do you think of him? And he said, he's a sick puppy. I thought that was interesting. Romney might have known about the puppy story.
Just throwing an extra little jab in there. I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it at all.
Yeah. Right.
Wow. You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Bob Benet. Bob's a former Ohio congressman, political analyst. I wanted to get your thoughts on the State of the Union. I think we talked about this the other day. In letting it simmer a little bit, any additional thoughts?
No, about the same as when you and I talked. I think that President Biden did what he needed to do for his soft launch. This is what this was. It was a soft launch, and he needed to have a soft launch because he's had a couple of polls, one from AP, taken amongst the Democrats, that doesn't say he's done a bad job, but they particularly don't want him to run again. So I thought it was important he make it soft launch, and the soft launch was easy, you know, to to see where he says, we did this, now we've got to, you know, continue. We've got to continue on. So that's what that amounted to. I thought for him, for what, you know, he needed to do, you know, he did it. I'm not sure right now, though, that the average person looked at the speech and said, okay, that's it. Oh, now I see. I thought he wove working people all through most of the speech, which he needed to do, manufacturing, Buy America, the chip factory in Ohio. I thought he did a really good job. But now that he's done that, they need to find a way to enforce this, you know, to get that mindset out there, what has been done, and his interest in helping the workers of America. Yeah. So I think it's important they follow up. If they don't, the speech is not going to carry it. They have to follow up.
Well, that's why he was on the road. I mean, he hit Madison, Wisconsin the next day, and then he was in Florida. He's got to go. He's got to follow this up for the next.
Sure.
I would say he should be living on the road for the next 6 months.
Right. I don't think it'll hurt him. I think being out there would be a good thing.
Yeah, being Uncle Joe out there shaking hands and doing all that stuff. Now, but here's the thing, you know, now aggressive wartime president almost, because we shot down what are they calling this now? Some kind of an aircraft of some sort, a floating craft. I guess it's about the size of a car that they shot down. Not a balloon, I guess, but some kind of aircraft object over Alaska. Thoughts?
Well, I thought it was interesting. Senator Murkowski made a really good point the other day. Now, once it was in our airspace in continental U.S., it became a different ballgame as where you shot it down, you know, because it was the size of three school buses. But she made a point the other day that, you know, the first line of defense when you're, you know, looking at the country is coming when these things come about is Alaska, and then that needs to be sharpened, you know? She said that. So along comes this one, and they nail it, you know, in Alaska. So she was on TV specifically tonight talking about, you know, the efforts and how much they thought it was good. So I think if these things are going to come in, try to get them when they come in what you would consider the first line of defense, which is coming via Alaska.
Now, what's interesting to me is, you know, when some of the intelligence talking heads have been coming out and saying, you know, by following this, and this is what I said from the beginning, by tracking this thing, by extracting information from it as it was, you know, transmitting whatever it was transmitting, they were able to find out a whole bunch of information, which is where I was from the beginning. This idea that you follow it, that you don't let anybody know you know, but you're basically spying on the spying. And this is what they're coming out and saying. Look, we now found the other three that we were, I guess, undetected during the Trump years. And this whole plot kind of thing. I also find it interesting that the Chinese didn't return the phone call after the blimp or the big balloon was shot down.
Well, I think there's a couple points. You make a really good point that originally I never thought about it a lot until I was thinking about how we gather information. This is not the days where you have the field operative CIA agent that, you know, has a girlfriend in Russia and she goes to work in Putin's office. You know, these days are past. So today it's about the electronic sides of things to find out and detect. And it is very, very possible that the balloon was followed for a couple of other reasons to actually be able to tap in on what was sent, what was being sent. So I mean that's very possible that, you know, they did that. The Chinese, of course, have become outraged over this to the point where they don't answer the hot phone. You know, look, we had the hotline between Kennedy and Khrushchev because, you know, at the end of the day, anybody in their right mind, unless Kim Jong Un, does not want, you know, a nuclear war. You've seen one, you've seen them all. And it's very interesting that the Chinese wouldn't even take the call. They were so, you know, so irritated and angry. But this is nothing new when you think about, you know, China and the government. I mean, it's an aggressive government. It's been aggressive to, you know, to come in and do what it can do. It got permanent trade status. It took our jobs. And then when we, you know, countered and tried to have diplomacy, China views it as weakness. So I think we probably shocked them more than anything by what we did, and now they don't even want to look like they're even, quote, soft enough to even take a phone call from the U.S. It's bad. It's not a good thing for them to react this way to the point where they won't even talk. Rick, one time I was on a U.S. carrier, and they said, listen to this, and the Iranians were talking to us, and we were talking to the Iranians, so there wasn't some misunderstanding about our ship and where it was.
Right.
So, this happens. It's normal they talk. So this is really abnormal that the Chinese have taken it to this point. Kim Jong-un, you could understand that, but at least the Chinese should be smart enough to pick up that phone.
Yeah, Un's crazy in North Korea. We get that. Yeah. But Xi Jinping, you would think, is a little more. So the question then comes back to then, are we at the beginning of, or have we been in the next Cold War? Only it's not us and Russia, it's us and China. Are we redividing the world up again in Cold War footing?
Well, I think it's a tough time. China has tried economically to buy off most of the world. They do that to go into countries and
that's our job.
Yeah, right. Yeah, except we don't spend our money to buy wisely. we spend it in wars in particular, but China's aggressive and it is worrisome where this heads to. I still will argue though, for those who say, well, we shouldn't have argued on the tariffs. I don't agree with that.
Not absolutely.
In fact, I think they would have stepped all over us like a doormat.
Yep.
If we weren't doing what Trump and what Biden have both done, I think we would be in real big trouble. That again, they view certain things as weakness. They don't view it as fairness.
No, I'm right there with you. It's the one thing that Trump did that I was all one of the things he did that I was sure. all on board with, without question. Last question I've got for you. Evidently, the White House, the president's interview during the Super Bowl was off. Now it's back on. Do you think we're going to have a presidential interview during the Super Bowl? And should we care? Can we stop this?
This was the Fox. This is the Fox interview. And, if I was Biden, would you really care?
No, I see. I'm of the mindset. I don't want it. Look, I like Biden. I think he's a good guy. I think he's Uncle Joe. I don't want that during the football game. I want to escape. Why do we have to have all these performances and all of this stuff? I want to see the damn football game.
Right. Yeah, I think so. And the White House today, basically said no. There's no hope of the pregame ritual. They didn't sign off on any exchange that was going to be done between the president and the Fox Corporation. They didn't say that they've ever signed off on that. Yeah. And again, I think you make a great point about this. It's just like I was talking to some people the other day, and they're not political people, but they don't like sometimes the politicization of the Grammys or the Oscars.
Yep.
That's turned people off too.
Yeah, don't care. I want to watch football. Isn't the place for it.
Saturday Night Live and comedians. They can.
There you go. Who's going to win? Any thoughts?
Well,
Philly or Kansas City? Pick
my
one.
My team's out of it. So
mine too.
I'm going to go. I would like to say the Eagles. I don't know. What do you think?
I really don't care. But being in being the fact that I live in Pennsylvania, I would be I'd be tortured and crucified if I didn't go with the Eagles. But being a Broncos fan, if I were to say Kansas City, that would get me my card would get pulled. But here's the thing: I'm at the point where do I want my card pulled because the Waltons own the Broncos? So I'm in this weird spot. But yes, I'm going to go with the Eagles. I'm going with the Eagles.
Right. I'll go with the Eagles too.
There you go. All righty, Bob, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Let's take a quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. Rufino Contreras gave his life to the labor movement. In the Imperial Valley of California, the United Farm Workers were engaged in a bitter labor strike against lettuce growers. Shortly before noon, Contreras and six other strikers walked onto a lettuce field owned by Mario Sakan in an attempt to try and talk to a group of 75 scabs brought in to break the strike. Before they could reach the scabs, shots rang out. Contreras was hit with a single bullet to the head. When Contreras' brother and some of the other strikers tried to recover the body, three foremen shot at them. Contreras lay in the lettuce field for more than an hour before an ambulance arrived. Sometimes, it's better to let the voices of history speak for themselves. Read from the statement issued by Cesar Chavez on this brutal murder. February 10th, 1979 was a day of infamy for farm workers. It was a day without hope. It was a day without joy. The sun did not shine. The birds did not sing. The rain did not fall. Why was this such a day of evil? Because on this day, greed and injustice struck down our brother Rufino Contreras. But we are here today to say that true wealth is not measured in money or status or power. It is measured in the legacy that we leave behind in those we love and those we inspire. In that sense, Rufino is not dead. Wherever farm workers organize, stand up for their rights, and struggle for justice, Rufino Contreras is with them. As for the three foreman shooters, Judge William Lenhart ruled that there was insufficient evidence to prove which of the three foremen killed Rufino. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So what a week. What a week it's been. I mean, really interesting. And you know, the State of the Union kind of just gobbled up a lot of the air, the oxygen. But Republicans in their now love of Social Security. Look, they've said it. And I've got a whole bunch of Republicans who've called me a liar saying, no, we would never. Republican voters are all in favor of Social Security. And I go, yeah, Republican voters, you know, working people are in favor of Social Security. Absolutely. Unquestioningly. But how about your leaders? Have you checked out the stuff that they've been saying? Oh, I know. They didn't put it in big, bold letters saying, I'm against Social Security. They talk in terms of entitlement reform. They use nice, soft language. We're just going to reform it. You know what entitlement reform means? It means screwing you out of your Social Security. That's what it means. It's that simple. So when you hear a politician go, we just need to reform the entitlements. What they're saying is that thing you've been paying into your whole life, that Social Security, that Medicare that you've been looking as part of your three-legged stool of pension money, of savings and Social Security, that, you know, they've destroyed the pension system. 40 years of stagnant wages have basically eroded any savings. And now the last leg of the stool that's still there, they want to whittle that down to a nub. That's you. That's saying you're never going to retire. You know, someone tweeted at us and asked the question, you know, what I think of letting 18-year-olds drive a truck. And this is another one of those examples of, you know, let's water down the labor pool. Let's get cheap labor in. Let's get these inexperienced young people who, I got to tell you, at 18, there was no way that I was mature enough to be behind the wheel of an 18-wheeler. There's no way. No way. And I don't think there are many 18-year-olds that are. What it's about? It's about, because they'll tell you, oh, we've got a driver shortage. No, what you've got is you've got a conditions shortage. How about making the job more family friendly? How about making the job better paying? How about making the job, you know, better wages, hours, conditions? Why people unionize? Why people fight? How about doing that? Getting people home more often so they can spend time with their family? How about doing that instead of, hey, let's get exploitable labor in? Let's get, you know, the cheaper young people to come in to work for peanuts. So I am against the idea of 18-year-olds driving a truck. I know, and they could go serve in the military. And yeah, absolutely. They drive trucks in the military. Those are different kind of 18-year-olds. The average 18, when I was 18, no way. I would have been that guy going, hey, this thing does 160 miles an hour. Let's try. Nothing good comes of that. Just my thoughts. I do want to hear yours. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, Make sure you grab the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. You'll find ours from iTunes to iHeart to Stitcher to Podbean, everywhere in between. We are there. Again, questions, comments, something on your mind, something make you angry, make you think, shoot me an email. I want to hear it. Hope you have a great weekend. Hope the Super Bowl is worth watching. I know my wife is excited about the commercials. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.